Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
I'm here with Bill Cohan in his Upper West Side apartment, which I'm just going to...
Intellectual's retreat.
I'm just going to say this. It's a beautiful home, beautiful artwork on the wall, which you clearly didn't get from your Vanity Fair salary because you were a banker before.
Yeah, I spent 17 years as an M&A banker on Wall Street, and you're right. These are the dividends of another career entirely.
Can you tell the servants to fetch me some pails of water?
Now, this is the Upper West Side, Nick. We do things ourselves here. we have a doorman. That's about as nice as it gets here.
The trials and tribulations. So most people go the opposite direction. They become journalists. They do that for a few years, and then they go be the banker at Goldman Sachs or something. What made you go in this direction?
Well, I sort of did that. I was a journalist. I went to Columbia Journalism School, graduated in 1983, and worked as a reporter on a daily paper in North Carolina for 2 years.
What was your beat?
I covered public schools, public education in Wake County, North Carolina, which was a doubly ironic because I've never been to a public school in my life. So they thought of me covering public education in Wake County, which was a really interesting beat because there was a lot of controversy at the time. They were trying to deal with how to integrate their schools in the inner city of Raleigh. And they came up with this program of quote-unquote magnet schools. And they had a carpetbagger school superintendent from New Jersey who came down and tried to implement a system of magnet schools. And things went off the rails a little bit. I wrote a bunch of stories that ended up getting him fired.
Oh, nice. So, good for you.
That was the way I sort of started there. And then I thought, well, what I really want to do is work at the Wall Street Journal. And I had always wanted to work at the Wall Street Journal, back in the days when the Bancroft family owned it, not now, with all due respect, even if Rupert's house is burning down outside of L.A.
Amen.
I wanted to work at the old Wall Street Journal because I thought their reporting and writing was exceptional. And so I had tried out of journalism school and without success. A lot of my classmates went on to great success at the Journal, like Tony Horowitz and Geraldine Brooks and Ron Suskind, but I could not follow in their footsteps. So I thought I would go to Columbia Business School. If I went back to business school and I had a business degree and a journalism degree, that would be it. That would be the secret to getting me to the Journal. That didn't happen either.
So you fell on your sword and went to...
So literally, I graduated in May of 87, and at that time, all you had to do was breathe and you get a job on Wall Street. So I couldn't get a job at the Wall Street Journal, but I could get a job at Wall Street. So then I spent the next 17 years as an M&A guy on Wall Street. And that's the source
of the servants and the...
Of the money that bought this apartment. But I bought it in 1991, which was when the market was quite low and it's appreciated considerably. And, you know, the art.
So I have a question. Let's just jump right in. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I cannot understand, and I'm hoping that you can shed light on this, is why the stock market is so high right now when so many people are terrified that the world is going to burn into oblivion.
Yeah, you know, Nick, you specialize in great questions on your podcast, and that's why I love it so much. That is a great question as well, and the reason that the stock market is so high is there are several reasons. One, the stock market is correlated with corporate earnings. Corporate earnings have been really high, basically all-time highs for, you know, 5 or 6 years now. The economy has been growing. Certain industries have been just gushing cash. J.P. Morgan Chase prints $7 billion in net income a quarter now. That's $28 billion a year. That's record. It's been record profits for the past 3 years. And a lot of companies, whether it's Google or Facebook, you know, they're really printing a lot of money. There is a correlation between stock price and profitability. That's number one. Why has it gone up so much? I think the main reason it's gone up so much is that because the bond market is an incredibly unattractive place to invest your money now.
All right, so I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that most of the people listening to this podcast don't know what that means.
Yeah.
Can you, as the former banker turned journalist, tell us how the bond market plays into the stock market being so high?
So the bond market is about 4 or 5 times the size of the stock market, which of course nobody even realizes.
Wow.
And what I mean by the bond market is that's all the money invested in corporate debt, in municipal debt, in U.S. Treasury debt. That's a lot of money, right? As big as we think of the stock market as, the bond market is 4 to 5 times bigger. It used to be 10 or 15 times bigger, but the stock market has outpaced it in the last decade or so. You know, when the stock market goes from 6,500 in March of 2009 to 24,200 today, that's a major league four times increase in valuations. And, you know, when Donald Trump boasts about how he's added whatever trillions of dollars of wealth to the country through the stock market that's gone up since he was elected, he's not wrong. But so you have to understand that there's a finite pool of capital that people can invest. They'll, most of the time, for simplicity's sake, they'll either invest it in the stock market or the bond market. The bond market has become much riskier than the stock market.
Why?
Why? Why? Because in the last 8 years, the Fed has pursued this zero interest rate policy. It has basically knocked down interest rates without getting into the details of how they did it and so-called quantitative easing and all that. They've knocked down interest rates to the lowest levels, you know, that we've seen in our history. Right. So, and for people, the simple way to think about this is when they look at their checking account and their savings account, what is the interest rate that they get from the bank on that? They get close to zero, you know, 0.1% or 0.25% interest. Interest rates are so low that investors don't want to invest in those securities because they can't get the yield that they want. To put it in sort of like a Hollywood terminology that you might appreciate, I think what's going on now is what I call the yield hunger games. So that people, investors around the world, are desperate for yield.
Yep.
And they can't get it in the bond market. Number one, because interest rates are so low. Number two, risk is being mispriced in the bond market. Because the Fed has gone in to artificially buy, I mean, the Fed's balance sheet has gone from $800 billion before the crisis to $4.5 trillion now.
So you're talking about the crisis in 2008?
2008, right. So the Fed has gone in and bought $3.7 trillion worth of bonds that they ordinarily would. They created demand in the bond market where it wouldn't ordinarily be. When you create more demand, artificial demand, that drives the prices of things up, and since interest rates trade in inverse proportion to their price, when you drive up the price of a bond, you drive down its yield.
And so how has the Fed buying up all of these bonds, has it not affected the dollar or a multitude of other things in negative ways? I mean, that money has to have been going somewhere else before that.
Well, so what the Fed has done by keeping interest rates so low, it's basically it's forced investors to say, where do I want to put my money? Mm. And they don't want to put it in bonds because interest rates are too low. And also, now that actually the Fed has decided to change course and is beginning to raise interest rates, you don't want to be an investor in the bond market when interest rates are rising. Because when interest rates rise, the value of your bond goes down. And unless you're holding it to maturity, that's a sucker's game. So you don't want to do that. And so why not invest in the stock market, especially, You know, corporate profits are high. There are plenty of dividend-yielding stocks that offer you more yield than bonds do, and you get the upside of the stock. You know, companies like Facebook and Apple and Google are just like going gangbusters. So basically, you've got a bubble in the bond market and a bubble in the stock market, which makes, frankly, investing very difficult. And ironically, to go back to your earlier point, leads people to be very worried.
But okay, so but if I'm worried, right, I am, my actions would speak that way. And it seems that the investing actions are not. They are still optimistic. I mean, maybe some is part of it as a result of the tax regulation that's going through? Is it part of it as a result of the deregulation of, you know, of all these laws that rules that Trump is putting back? So all of those are, you're nodding your head.
Yes.
Right?
Right. I'm nodding my head because the answer is yes. A lot of people are excited to think that corporate profits are going to, that have been high, are going to stay high, because when you cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20, already there's 15 basis points of increase, presumably in profits, assuming that these companies actually paid a 35% tax rate. So corporate profits could go even higher. Trump is rolling back regulations across industries, meaning that it's, you know, the Wild West is returning. You know, if you want to drill in the Anwar, you know, go ahead, drill. If you want another 1 million acres out in Utah, you know, fine, do what the heck you want with it. I mean, so basically Trump is saying, you know, and in Wall Street, regulation is coming off left and right. So I think the market's big move from 17,000 when Trump got elected to 24,000 today, which is, you know, a big move in the Dow, is a result of people anticipating that he would be able to roll back and do some of the things. You know, one of the great virtues of the Donald Trump presidency is his incompetence. If he could actually do more, it would be scary. But the few things that he has accomplished are actually, are helpful to corporate profits and the stock market.
Okay, so but this is not sustainable indefinitely, right? I mean, you've got what are the things that could happen to make it all plummet? What my question is and the reason I came all this way today to the Upper West Side from Hollywood, I want to understand, like, how does this end? Because it seems like it's going to end badly.
Yeah, it doesn't end with a whimper. It ends with a bang. And it ends with a bang because given Trump, you're probably going to have some sort of exogenous event.
Like, are we talking war? Are we talking...
I mean, we could be talking about... I mean, again, with Trump, one doesn't know for sure. I mean, he lit the powder keg today in the Middle East, right? That was a self-inflicted wound. Didn't need to do that. He's picking a fight with a mini-me dictator in North Korea who's now got intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the West Coast or even the East Coast. I mean, just for fun, he could lob one of those around. That certainly would disrupt people's outlook on the markets. I think that... I have argued in Vanity Fair that this could be the first tax plan that causes a recession. If it causes a recession, then obviously corporate profits are going to go down and the stock market is going to go down.
So that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, your recession beliefs. Why do you think that this tax plan, which clearly benefits certain people that like to spend money, would then in turn result in the opposite of that happening?
I think that one of the provisions, this elimination of state and local tax deductibility, affects people directly in five large states: California, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, and Illinois. In those states, generally speaking, people's single largest asset is their home.
Correct.
If you can no longer deduct state and local taxes, much of which is property tax related, yep, then the cost of operating your home on an annual basis is going to go up. If the cost of operating your home on an annual basis goes up, then the value of the home is going to go down, because somebody looking to buy your home is going to say, well, I'd pay you this, but now, you know, the state and local tax deduction has gone away, and it's going to cost me, you know, 6% more or whatever to own this house. So if it's going to cost me 6% more on an annual basis to own this house, I only want to pay you, you know, this much money, which is going to be considerably less than it was worth, you know, before they passed this tax plan. Now, some people would say, well, the home prices have gotten out of hand. Young people can't afford homes now. This would enable younger people to afford homes. That isn't that all to the good. But if your largest asset is your home and you're not feeling nearly as wealthy as you were before the tax plan, because Lord knows most of the tax plan is geared to the super rich and not, you know, ordinary Americans, then, you know, your wallet is going to be closed at Christmas time and at birthday time and all these other times when you might otherwise be spending money. And if you're not spending money, then we are a consumer-driven economy, then the economy slows and you head into a recession. If we go into a recession, then the stock market falls, interest rates go up, and bond prices fall, and it's sort of a disaster scenario.
Cats and dogs living together.
Even absent the exogenous, intangible Donald Trump effect.
So,
which frankly, I think in the last year we've been very fortunate to avoid. You know, he's like a high beta individual.
Okay, so last question on this topic, and then I want to switch a little. The recession these new tax rules and so on and so forth with that you just mentioned are clearly going to stop people from buying homes. Do you believe that will be because that's where it affects, it mostly affects new homes, correct?
Well, or existing homes, the secondary market of homes. So it'll affect new home sales for a period of time. It'll affect, you know, secondary home sales. I mean, you know, it takes time for buyers and sellers to adjust their expectations.
But so my question is, do you think that is going to be the thing that precipitates everything else, kind of like a domino effect?
I do. When your biggest asset is not worth what you thought it was, you know, a few months ago, the so-called wealth effect in reverse, you're feeling poorer, you're not going to open your wallet to buy a new car or to buy a new refrigerator or to go out to dinner for the 17th time.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Now, I'm sure you've heard of HelloFresh, the scrumptious meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers your favorite step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. But I'm here today to tell you what makes them so amazing. You get to choose your delivery day, when you want it, and when it works best for you and your schedule. You could pause your account if you're going out of town. All the ingredients come pre-measured in handy labeled meal kits, so you don't have to figure out which ingredient goes with which recipe and so on and so forth. HelloFresh has tons of chef-curated recipes that change weekly, and they have so many options for all us picky eaters out there. There's the veggie option, the meat-based option, fish, you name it. So I've been using HelloFresh for a few weeks, and some of my personal favorites are the Juicy Lucy Burger with tomato, onion, jam, and arugula salad. It is amazing. I know you're probably starving just listening to this. Another one is the lobster ravioli and shrimp with tomatoes and tarragon. This ad is making me so hungry right now. I personally love cooking, but I love HelloFresh more. The food is just so simple to prepare. There's no wasted produce or leftovers, and it's just delicious. One thing that HelloFresh is doing is it's giving listeners of Inside the Hive $30 off the first week that they order from HelloFresh. All you need to do is order from HelloFresh.com and enter the code HIVE30. Once again, that's HIVE30. Once again, just go to HelloFresh.com, enter the code HIVE30, and you're going to get $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. I guarantee you're going to love the food. It's going to be simple to prepare, and you're probably never going to want to go out or go to the grocery store ever again. All right, now that you've depressed me. Well, maybe it's not. I mean, it's like this bitter, this honestly, that I'd be quite frank, there's a bittersweet part of it. It's because it drives me batshit that I see Donald Trump on TVs being like, I made the Dow what it is today, and And there's a big part of me, although I don't want to see the country fall into recession and people's homes and so on and so forth, there's a big part of me that would like to see him not be able to say that. Because I don't believe he deserves to say that.
He doesn't deserve to say that.
Because if you look at the markets under Obama...
The market was, in March of 2009, was 6,500. When Obama left office, it was 17,000 or 17,500. So, I mean, so most of that goes to Obama. The move from 17 to 24, okay, we have to give that to the Trumpster.
We're not giving it to him. I'm sorry.
Chronologically,
yes,
we do.
Yes, I'm joking, I'm joking.
But, you know, you're right. I mean, this economy was set in motion by the Obama administration. By the way, you know, I think these things are cyclical. Don't forget, we had a massive financial crisis in 2008 that really began in 2007. And so, you know, people were really bleak. People lost their homes. You know, consumer spending contracted. I mean, so, you know, eventually people forget that and get out of their funk, and the animal spirits start moving again. The animal spirits were already revved up well before Donald Trump became president a year ago.
So you, on Wall Street, you spent quite a bit of time, and I look at Wall Street almost like I take my kids to the zoo sometimes, and there's certain animals that I don't know what they eat and what they do and like why they're here. Can you kind of, I mean, what is the culture like? Is it what we see in the movies? Is it like this, this, you know, beating your chest and corporate jets and, you know, hookers and fast cars? I mean, what?
Well, I've written, obviously, a lot about this.
Yeah, a lot of books.
So, I mean, I've written books that explore the culture of Wall Street at various firms. I've written, after The Wolf of Wall Street came out, I wrote a column in the New York Times about how that's not what it's like on Wall Street. People are not taking Quaaludes and then going on their back to get into their Lamborghini and driving off from the country club. You know, there were, I suppose, a dwarf tossing at one point. I mean, a lot of that. I mean, we're talking about.
I love that. There were, I suppose, if we really have to get into the nitty gritty.
I mean, I never saw it, but yeah. I've seen heard tell of it. Most of the time, it's just people kind of working really hard, getting paid well, but probably not as well as they used to, because now the people who get paid the best are people who work at hedge funds or private equity firms. But, you know, Wall Street people still get paid much better than, say, if they were a journalist or working for a monthly magazine or a teacher or a plumber or pretty much anything else that they could do without risking their own capital.
Now, has the culture changed a lot? I mean, especially since 2008, or is it kind of, was that the way it is now and that's the way it was then?
It's a little hard for me to know for sure. I mean, I know from osmosis and I know from my friends and I know from reporting. I left Wall Street in 2004, and I can tell you it was cutthroat, ruthless. You know, the scars, I have scars on my back from working there for 17 years. You know, yes, you got paid well, but, you know, psychologically you paid a big price. You know, it was really a cutthroat Darwinian environment. As used to be said at Lazard, it wasn't enough for you to succeed, others have to fail. So, I mean, there aren't many professions where that is a mantra.
Yeah.
I think it's slightly more sober.
The White House, maybe that could be a mantra.
That could be a mantra, yes. In Congress, that could be a mantra. There are, you know, several places where there's zero-sum games. Wall Street is one big zero-sum game. You know, think about it. The bonus pool is, a fixed amount of money every year. And the number of people who work there are fixed and who are going to get bonuses. So if you get if your bonus is X, that means somebody else's bonus has to be X minus or X plus. So if somebody gets a higher bonus, that means you're going to get a lower bonus. So, it's the jockeying is very intense, especially at this time of year. I mean, people aren't working anymore or basically aren't working. They're just worried about what their bonus is going to be. But I think that because of the re-regulation of Wall Street and Dodd-Frank and what a lot of things that used to be sort of, when Wall Street used to be sort of a light touch regulatory environment, which, by the way, we're going back to. But in this interim period from, say, 2010, when Dodd-Frank passed, to now, for the last 7 years, I think Wall Street's been a bit more sober than it was when I was there. And people work really hard. Sometimes it's a lot of busy work. Sometimes it's on real transactions. And, it's as ruthless as ever.
Now, do you have any good stories?
I mean, I've written books.
We could read them aloud on the. Yeah. We could do a reading. Do you have? Yeah. Do you have a? Can you give us one good one?
Do you want Wall Street stories or Donald Trump stories?
You spent time with Trump, right?
Yeah, I have. I've
let's spent, do it. Let's go yeah, with. We'll a, do a little, let's do a Trump story.
A little Trump action. This is truly one of my favorite all-time stories, whether or not, I mean, the fact that it involves Trump is just all the more delicious. So in 2013, before Trump was a candidate, when he was just a mediocre real estate developer in Manhattan, whose specialty was golf courses, I was assigned by The Atlantic to write a piece about what Wall Street thought about Donald Trump. And it was a long piece, one of those nice big Atlantic pieces. And basically it covered the idea that Wall Street hates Donald Trump, hates doing business with him, and for good reason, because he had somewhere between 4 and 6, the number keeps changing. You know, it's funny, The Atlantic has like rigorous fact-checking, much like Vanity Fair, and we fact-checked this rigorously and came up with the conclusion that 4 of his companies had gone bankrupt. You know, since he's been, candidate and then president, somehow that number's gone up to 6. So I don't know where the other 2 came from, but somewhere between 4 and 6 of his companies have gone bankrupt. That means that Wall Street banks and their investors have lost billions of dollars as a result of Donald Trump. So they don't want to have anything to do with him. And that's why, the best he can do for borrowing money lately has been through the German bank, Deutsche Bank, which may or may not be the subject of Mueller's subpoena today. So I write this piece, and I also included it such nuggets as that Donald Trump cheats at golf.
That he cheats at golf?
Cheats at golf, and that a lot of Wall Street people who play golf with him know and watch and see him cheating at golf.
How does he cheat, out of curiosity?
Oh, I mean, there's so many different ways. But, I mean, I've had friends of mine tell me that, he wanted to get into this club on Long Island called Deepdale, which is sort of a Tony, prestigious, WASPy club on the North Shore of Long Island. And Trump recently, just before he became president, wanted to get in. And I'm told that the head of the club didn't want him in for obvious reasons. And he's so uncouth. And so they said, well, look, we know he cheats. So keep an eye out for him cheating. So if he cheats, that's going to be, we can't let him in. So, the first hole, not much of an incident. The second hole, he shanks his drive way off to the right into the woods. And he proceeds to march up the middle of the fairway in imperious Donald Trump fashion, with his caddy trailing like 10 paces behind. And all of a sudden, my friend hears out of the corner of his ear, Mr. Trump, I found your ball. You walked right by it. Can you, it's back here. So Donald goes back and, hits his second shot from the middle of the fairway instead of, taking a penalty stroke because he'd hit his ball into the woods. And, of course, that was enough to ding him from Deepdale. So that was the end of the Donald at Deepdale. I don't know if he knows why he got dinged, but that's why you got dinged, Donald, because you cheat at golf. So, of course, he says to me, I never cheated at golf, William. I never cheated at golf.
That's a good impression.
And, I don't need to cheat at golf because I'm a club champion, I don't need to cheat at golf. And how dare you say I cheat at golf? So the article came out, and I was asked to go on Bloomberg TV to talk about it. And the anchors, part of actually what the article revealed was that he's actually not the worst businessman in the world. He may be the worst real estate developer, but he's smart enough to know not to put his own capital into several of his new buildings over time. And he just lent his name in exchange for fees. So that, I think, was a relatively intelligent step on his part so that he wasn't putting his capital at risk. So the anchors on Bloomberg were sort of trying to get me to say that he really was a bad businessman, and I was saying, well, he's not as bad as you think. He made a clever decision to back away from using his own capital to build buildings, but to actually use his name and get fees for his name. And incredibly, so that happens, and I heard that Donald didn't like the article, which is standard. And then, a few months later, Graydon asked me to write a piece for Vanity Fair about the Schneiderman lawsuit with Trump about Trump University, which at that time, Graydon is so prescient that he knew it would become something. And of course, it did. But that time, nobody was following it. So I write...
This is 2013?
This is 2014. So again, no, he's not a candidate. Not even... going back to The Atlantic, one of the kicker of that piece was that Trump told me that he should have stayed in the 2012 race because he would have won. That's what he told me. And I thought that was such a joke and so preposterous that I used it as the kicker to my piece. Okay, so then in 2014, I'm writing, I have to call him up again and see if he'll be interviewed. And I'm thinking, well, I know he didn't like the Atlantic piece. Can he possibly resist Vanity Fair? A story about, Trump University and his legal debate with Eric Schneiderman. So I call him up, and he basically tells me how much he hates the Atlantic article and how much he hates Graydon Carter. And and then he says to me, but I was watching you on Bloomberg when you did that interview about the Atlantic piece, and they tried to bait you to say bad things about me, but you didn't, and I really appreciated that. So as a result, I'm going to talk to you now. And then he said the best line of all times. He said, like me, and this is key, like me, you're a good-looking guy and you have a great head of hair.
Did you laugh on the phone? Like, what did you...
I have laughed about that so many times since then. That is literally part of the family lore.
Now. Like me.
Like me. That's the key.
You're a good-looking guy.
Those two words are the key. Like me.
So now, does it make you question if you are ugly and have thinning hair?
I'm wondering, do I have an orangutan on top of my head? Is that what he sees? Is that what I have?
Have you spoken to any of these, your Wall Street sources or buddies or whatever, after Trump won and or even in the past few months and what they think about all this?
I think they're dumbfounded. I mean, there's no way anybody...
There are a lot of people in this country that are not dumbfounded.
I understand that. And I think we're still, sitting here on the Upper West Side of New York, I think people are still trying to reconcile that a year later. I think people are still having trouble. I mean, don't forget, New Yorkers knew what this guy was about. I find it so fascinating that New Yorkers knew what this guy was about, but yet we failed. This is the media capital of the country, right? Failed to convey that information to the rest of the country.
Well, that's because I just left. I just had a Tim Wu interviewing him for next week's podcast, and he was talking about the attention market that we live in today, and so on and so forth. And he said, the thing that Trump is the best at is being able to manipulate anything to his own will as far as attention goes. And I think that the media, we fell to that, right?
I mean, absolutely. I believe Les Moonves, whether he was joking or not, he said it was taken out of context. Okay, I believe him. At CBS, the CEO of CBS said that Trump has been the best thing that's come along for CBS in a long time. And I'm sure that Jeff Zucker feels the same way.
And the New York Times and Vanity Fair.
And the Washington Post and you name it. But I think people are getting, frankly, a little sick of it all.
Yeah, I think... I actually
even west of the Hudson, I think they're really getting sick of it.
Do you think that? When did you first meet him?
2013.
2000 for that story.
Yes.
Did you think he was preposterous immediately when you first met him, or was it was it a gradual preposterousness that snuck in?
Well, I mean, again, you have to remember the context. He was somebody who had been in the 2012 presidential race for a nanosecond.
He was in the 2008 and 2 and also governor.
Also for a nanosecond, right? Yeah. And then when he said, well, I should have stayed in 2012 because I would have won because Mitt Romney. So I thought that was a joke. I mean, I really thought he was displaying a sense of humor. And so but it would have serious sense of, so I used that as the kicker. So, I mean, to me, I mean, to New Yorkers, not just to me, Donald Trump has always been a buffoon. I mean, you know, whether it's tabloid headlines or his gaudy buildings or, I mean, you know, we're just up the street from the gaudiest buildings that have ever been constructed in this city along the Riverside Drive, you know, where he first owned it. He talked about building the tallest building in the world, Television City, and that didn't happen. And then he lost control of the development, and it went to some Hong Kong businessmen. And then he put his name on the buildings. And then after he got elected president, the people who lived there wanted their names off the buildings. So we knew that he was, frankly, nothing short of a buffoon. But
now happens to be a buffoon president. I know you only have a few minutes. You've got to run off to do a TV interview. But I want to get your take on Bitcoin. Mm. Have you you own any Bitcoins? Did you buy them or?
I do not.
Do you regret not buying them?
No, I don't regret.
Do you think, as you know, someone that understands the way these markets work and so on and so forth? I mean, today it's already. I mean, last I checked, it was like 13,500 almost.
Do you have it connected to your heart monitor? I mean,
no, I have. I'm really interested in cryptocurrencies, yeah. I check them a lot and get little alerts when they hit certain numbers.
Well, look, you had. I mean, one of the great, and I encourage people to listen to it. The interview you did with the Winklevi about, you know, took their $45 million of Facebook winnings and turned it into a $1 billion Bitcoin fortune.
Probably, I think it's now up to almost like $1.6 billion or something insane.
It's just basically astounding. Of course, I'm wondering: do they date? Where are the girlfriends? Do they spend all their time just
playing guitar,
mining bitcoins? I mean, so look, Bitcoin, to me, it's like tulip bulbs.
You think it's going to crash like that?
I mean, it's not tied to anything. It's not, there's nothing.
But technically, gold isn't really tied to anything these days.
But at least gold is made into jewelry.
Yeah, but how many people wear gold jewelry? I mean, it seems that gold is more of a
Nebuchadnezzar, King Amagam,
Donald Trump.
I mean, Donald Trump, all through his triplex and Trump Tower. Look, I mean, at least there's a use for gold. Bitcoin, I suppose. And look, you're much more knowledgeable about it.
I'm just curious if from a financial standpoint, it seems that there are,
every day people are talking about it.
Yes.
Every single day.
Yeah.
You know, when it goes up like this, people wonder, what's it all about? What have I missed? Is it too late for me? Should I get into it? I was speaking up in Massachusetts last night, and the speaker, like 2 weeks before me, had been speaking about Bitcoin, and a guy who was in the audience says he bought it for like $3,000, and now it's, you know, $13,500. And so he's happy. I mean, there are people, a lot of people who are happy, but, you should invest in things that you understand. I mean, look, I have an investment manager, so I don't do my own investing. So, I mean, and he
you
would.
You should make your investment manager the Winklevi.
Well, I wish I had taken my $45 million from Facebook and given it to the Winklevi to turn it into this. I mean, it's a great story, the Winklevi. They've been a great story for a decade now.
Yeah, no,
but I don't have.
They're
the
smart.
Answer. Of course, they're smart.
Yeah, they don't get the credit they deserve. I think they were played by dumb people on television in the movies.
Yeah.
I know you have to get out of here, but I have one last question for you. Do you think how long do you think the market is going to continue on its trajectory? And do you think this is, like, is this something that normal consumers listening to this, if they've made it this far, should actually be worried about?
Absolutely. I mean, what you should do now for normal people who are in the market and who've made a lot of money, you know, relatively speaking on a percentage basis in the last year, I mean, the market owes people nothing at this point, nothing. We're at new highs all the time. It's beyond what anybody thought would be likely, especially in you know, the last year since Donald Trump was elected. So the market owes you nothing. I don't be greedy. Take a bunch of money out. A bunch. I mean, I'm talking about a lot. And even if you don't know what to do with it, just leave it in the bank or put it under your mattress, because you're going to be glad in a year. Because in a year, sometime within the next year, you know, between now and the elections in 2018, something is going to, it's a guarantee. I mean, the guy is a high beta individual, and, you know, the market owes you nothing. The tax bill is on the verge of being passed, so that's already baked into the market. So to me, it's just a question of not if, it's just a question of when it's going to correct. And corrections are good, by the way. You got to take some of the air out of this. I mean, you know, Warren Buffett always invests after the correction, and that's clearly a smart thing to do.
Well, I think if you do sell your money in the stock market, you should buy Bitcoin.
It's or you know, what is the other one?
Litecoin, Ethereum.
Ethereum, yeah.
Monero. This, right, you know, there's a long list.
Can I invest in the Winklevoss ETF?
I think you can invest. I think that it's on the verge of being able to invest in their fund. I'll give you their number. You can call
anything
them.
To do with the Winklevoss, I'm very interested in.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guest, Bill Cohan. If you enjoyed this conversation and it didn't scare you too much, it scared me, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. And don't forget to leave a glowing, 5-star, beautiful, fantastic, amazing, gorgeous review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. Thanks to my editors at Vanity Fair. But thanks most of all to my sponsor this week, HelloFresh. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week, and I have a fantastic guest who is truly fascinating and will blow your mind with some of the things that we're going to talk about. So be sure to tune in next week. Have a great week. Thanks.
Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.